Great way to network PhD programs. I'm out, fortunately, and Matt's still working on it. So had some great presentations so far. I'm going to go into a case study of global health diplomacy and try to practically apply it to a current crisis. And what we'll be talking about is the Ukraine. And a lot of people actually forgot about the Ukraine, and I know we're all supposed to do this, no relationships to disclose, but none of us, I don't think, have a conflict of interest. But a lot of us have talked about the Ukraine crisis from the context of foreign policy. But there's actually a public health crisis going on in Ukraine as well, and that gets drowned out a lot by the media and also by the framing of this crisis as, you know, an energy issue or EU integration issue. So we'll be talking about the foreign policy and diplomatic repercussions for the Ukraine crisis, the policy science analysis that we're trying to use to further health diplomacy in the space, and then hopefully a pathway forward, which we published but obviously hasn't gotten much traction because this crisis is still ongoing and the public health crisis within it is also not resolved. So to begin, most of you have been probably following the Ukraine crisis. It's been going on since 2013. I think there's some media fatigue about it, so a lot of people aren't really paying attention too much about it, but it's still an ongoing crisis, and it started obviously because of this tension between, you know, pro-West and pro-East type of factions and the EU integration question that was actually led to a number of protests and the political crisis that's currently engulfing the country. Within this crisis, Crimea was annexed in February 2014 by pro-Russian forces. There was a public referendum. It's not recognized internationally, and it led to the official annexation of this territory within the Ukraine. Again, this is not just a country-to-country crisis. It's actually a regional crisis, and it's, again, being drowned out by a lot of the discussion about EU migration and, of course, the conflict in the Middle East. But again, it's an extremely important conflict that has emerged, and it's kind of reminiscent of our old Cold War type of conflicts that we've had in the past. Shows that we're not necessarily in this 21st century era of globalization. We still have some of these old machinations going on. The most important part for us as public health professionals is there's a public health crisis going on within the Ukraine. And this is really led by the fact that Russia accounts for 55% of all new HIV infections in Eastern Europe. And this is because they ban opioid substitution therapy, or methadone maintenance therapy, MMT. I'm going to use OST as an acronym now, which if you're in substance abuse, you know that this is a very effective treatment modality to reduce transmission of infectious diseases, specifically HIV/AIDS, and address substance abuse. And this is at the same time when the Ukraine was receiving a lot of technical assistance from the WHO, from other NGOs, and they were really reversing their own domestic HIV epidemic through the provisioning of OST. When Russia annexed Crimea, Russian law became federal law for Crimea as well, and that led to an immediate suspension of OST within the region. Now, the one thing about, again, OST is it's internationally recognized by the WHO, the UNAIDS, and also UNODC. And if you know anything about UNODC, this is a position change that's only occurred in the last 5 or 6 years, where UNODC has gone away from an enforcement principle towards more of a harm reduction principle. So this is a big deal that UNODC is also an endorser of OST. Over 60 countries worldwide have made OST available, and the Russian ban means that it's the only country in the Council of Europe that actually doesn't allow for OST provision. The impact, of course, on the individual clients at the micro level of the risk environment is imprisonment, return to drug use, overdose, health complications, and even reported death or suicide because people just can't manage their substance abuse or their addiction because they're not available to have OST treatment. So it's serious for the individual user. When this OST ban came into place after the annexation of Crimea, approximately 14,000 clients lost services to OST. And this could undermine progress that was made by the Ukrainian public health stakeholders in also developing integrative health delivery services, trying to combat other infectious diseases like HIV, specifically hepatitis C, and also TB. And of course, the social repercussions that are associated with substance abuse. The one thing that we're concerned about, particularly in this study, and we'll talk about a little bit later, is the potential convergence of HIV, TB, and Hep C, given that people who inject drugs are really at the very center of a lot of these infectious diseases. So when you eliminate OST as a treatment, these individuals may go back to injection drug use, and of course you can have the spread of these infectious diseases, especially in areas where outbreaks have been very common. On top of this, Ukraine already has a very weakened public health system that has been struggling through funding mechanisms and different things that have challenged the system. It actually has one of the lowest life expectancies in Europe and a below average human development index as well. So you can imagine what this particular crisis is doing to its public health infrastructure and the fact that it's really, you know, there's a lot of economic repercussions associated with this crisis. So again, syndemic potential we're concerned about is the fact that there's already a high prevalence of HIV in these regions, and these control and prevention programs that have just started to you know, bring benefits have actually been very negatively impacted by this crisis. Of course, Russia has its own TB problem, especially in prisons. So these countries are geographically in close proximity. So you can imagine that this potential cross-border transmission can occur. And also, there's a hidden epidemic of hepatitis C among people who inject drugs. And this is very much associated with Russia's draconian OST policies. This picture, I think, provides a perfect example. This is a woman, 37, in Russia. She's actually suffering from malnutrition, and she also suffers from TB, Hep C, and HIV. So she's an example of a person that's actually impacted directly by the syndemic. And that is, of course, influenced by Russia's policies. So what have been the reactions to this OST ban within Crimea? Well, civil society has acted. The International Network for People Who Use Drugs has led a broad coalition of NGOs and academics who have tried to pressure the UN Security Council and also the you know, special agencies to call for an international ban. To call for international pressure to push back the Russian OST ban as a principal matter of human rights. And the argument that they've made from a legalistic perspective is pretty smart. So they've looked at international law and said, what are the pressure points we can use? One is the human right to health, and the other one is access to medicines. And if you've read a lot of UN resolutions, which I have unfortunately done, you know a lot of UN resolutions associated with access to medicines are about HIV. So there is international law and binding resolutions that basically support international consensus that people should have access to HIV treatment. OST could be a provision of that as well. Others, including the International HIV-AIDS Alliance and the Elton John Foundation, have also joined INPUD in their call for pushing back the ban. In addition, the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights has investigated potential human rights abuses in Ukraine. I know you can't read it, but in this paragraph is a section that talks about how OST provisioning healthcare facilities are now being controlled by armed groups, and people just can't get access anymore. And they specifically mentioned that this can lead to the risk of HIV and Hep C. So there's some negative repercussions for Russia as well. So as you know, Russia is continuing to become isolated from the international community, including the Syria conflict that's going on. And this has led to political and economic isolation, including exclusion from a number of international meetings that are very important, including the G8 meeting and an OECD meeting, and its withdrawal from the Council of Europe for its voting rights. And this includes exclusion from scientific cooperation that's been really robust. Most of you probably know that Russia and U.S. have had a strong bilateral tie when it comes to scientific partnership, and that is at risk as well. So some of the things we look at when we try to apply some policy science, I guess you could say, and policy I think is one of the first steps to understanding diplomacy as well, is we try to apply some of these concepts to understand what's going on in the crisis and what policy science approaches can, you know, inform solutions. So one of the things we do is a Venn diagram. That's pretty easy. You're just looking for commonalities and interests across the two different stakeholders. One thing, economics, both the Ukraine and Russia, because Russia is being impacted by economic sanctions, have a vested interest to get this conflict kind of under wraps because they, both of their own economies are suffering in different ways. Of course, there's some political optics associated with that as well. They have a transnational infectious disease risk here as well because they're so close geographically located. One outbreak in one country is, of course, an outbreak in both. So they have an interest there to resolve the conflict there as well. And the really central question to this presentation and pretty much all of what we're talking about in health diplomacy is health that smart tool that can bring together two countries to negotiate something? Is health the commonality and putting public health first in diplomacy actions, can that be a factor that brings two countries together and really negotiates a good settlement? So we've shown this pyramid a few times. I use the same pyramid to map out my forum analysis when I look at who is responsible for this crisis, or and who can be influenced to bring out a positive outcome. So at the core diplomacy level, we're really talking about state-to-state actions. And we feel from our analysis that taking a human rights approach to it is the best way to do it. We have a set of international guiding principles and international law that reaffirms the right to health as a human right, as well as access to medicine. So it's a really good place. We have the Political Declaration on HIV and AIDS, which actually is a very strongly worded international instrument that can help us in this particular crisis right now. And of course, if we have a UN General Assembly binding resolution protecting this fundamental right to health and saying that OST ban is a violation of that human right, then I think that we can move this issue forward. So that's at the very top level of the pyramid. That's what we should be working for. But there's also other things we can do in the midsection of the pyramid, in the multi-stakeholder diplomacy section. And that includes engaging agencies, UN specialized agencies like WHO, UNAID, UNAIDS, UNODC, and procurement agencies like the Global Fund that can actually provide technical assistance now within the country. So that includes funding for OST within regions that are outside of Crimea. So yes, clients will have to travel, but they'll still have access. And the most important thing is impacted areas will still have access to their MMT or the methadone maintenance therapy. And, you know, again, we can even fund the ability for clients to travel outside of Crimea or relocate. So those are things we can do now outside of the scope of formal bilateral negotiations. And that can be enforced actually through a memorandum of understanding or some other partnership model. And it's important because we talk a lot about health diplomacy, but a lot of people wonder, is it accessible to me as a public health professional? Well, we have this last space of the pyramid that is really informal diplomacy. And the way I view it is we can influence policy, which can then somehow influence foreign policy, which then hopefully can influence the top of the pyramid, which is actual diplomacy. And this is something that can be done across international public health actors, the public, other non-state actors. And, you know, there's an NGO framework in place. And we're hoping that this advocacy on the grassroots level can lead to change across the pyramid cascade. One of the things that's really amazing that NGOs are doing, they're actually informing clients how to exercise their legal rights within Russian courts to say, yes, I should have access based upon federal Russian law. It doesn't work, but it's a good advocacy tool. You know, sue the Russian government and say, you know, I have a fundamental right to OST based upon federal law. Again, it doesn't really work very well, but it's a good advocacy tool. And it's important to raise that advocacy level in country and outside of country as well. So there's a number of organizations doing that. This is a mapping of all the different channels you have for global health diplomacy. So we see core diplomacy at the bottom with all the multilaterals and also the bilaterals that different nation states and different actors can approach. We have informal diplomacy, and we have a number of different actions that each one can take, and we have that multi-stakeholder diplomacy. I feel that there's an emphasis for need of coordination and policy coherence across multi-stakeholder and informal, though you could argue the same thing at the core diplomacy level, but I think that's a little bit less accessible than these two other stakeholders. And there's a whole other avenue of science diplomacy as well, because we have this strong scientific partnership with Russia. We have channels to negotiate in that space. And health can be one of those channels that we emphasize. We also want to do a quick assessment matrix of what's the outcome of these policies that we're going to put forth. So let's say we want to do a complete ban on OST. We want a complete lifting of the ban on OST. Well, for Ukraine, the outcome is positive because they can get OST provisioning in their country. For Russia, it's clearly negative because it convenes their federal law. It's not easy to turn around 50, 60 years of federal law and a very structured approach to, you know, substance abuse, let's call it that way. And it's not harm reduction. One of the things that Russia offers to Crimean clients is that they can go back to Russian hospitals for their treatment, which is not the most viable treatment opportunity for them. So again, you know, they're obviously not committed to harm reduction. And the enforcement is hard also, because even if you have an international lifting of the ban, Russia may just not listen to it. They may listen better to economic sanctions instead. Continued OST ban in Crimea is obviously negative for the Ukraine. It's positive for Russia because its existing policy stance is maintained. This is an international issue of policy for them. And the enforcement is neutral, of course, because it's just the status quo as it is now. Now, one of the things that can be approached is what's called a non-enforcement agreement, which means your law is still on the books, but Russia, as a country, we just agree not to enforce it. So that's another avenue that can be approached from a policy standpoint that results in informal assistance to impacted countries. So Russia's not going to provide assistance, and Russia's not going to agree that OST is allowed in that country, but it's just saying, hey, we're not going to prosecute against users or provisioning services. It allows Russia to save face in this negotiated settlement process and can actually be used as a bargaining chip in future ceasefire negotiations. If you didn't get any of this, or if you fell asleep, or if you are not really interested in the Ukraine or OST, the paper's not going to help you. But if you are interested, this has been published in the Journal of International Aid Society with my co-author, Stephanie Strathy, who is a renowned social epidemiologist. What we really did was Michelle Kazashkin, who's the UN, forget his title, he's an ambassador to HIV in Eastern Europe. He put together this great piece in the BMJ that basically brought up this issue that said these clients don't have access, they're dying, and it's all because of this political BS, basically. And what we did was we just wanted to expand that study or that commentary and talk about what were the health diplomacy angles to this. What's a mechanism of action moving forward, not in the biomedical, you know, context, but, you know, from a foreign policy context? And really, is health diplomacy that important? And can it be inserted into this foreign policy issue? So I'm going to skip the first two bullet points. You've already heard me talk about that. But there is, again, an existing partnership between the U.S. and Russia through what's called the Bilateral Presidential Commission, which exists. And, health should be a component here. And I believe it's not a major component, but it could fall under science and technology. We actually can share a lot of resources when it comes to Hep C treatment, one avenue for diplomacy there. And, development of TB diagnostics. There's a lot of technology sharing that can happen there. Let's agree to some partnership on health in this particular space. Right now, heavy fighting has broken out again. We're in the middle of a brokered ceasefire that is at risk in multiple different ways. And, I think this is the end of my discussion, but the major point that we bring up is foreign policy driving health, or is health driving foreign policy? In this particular case study, doesn't seem like health or public health has gotten really into the space of foreign policy yet. In this particular crisis, health is not an important issue. We're drowned out by the other issues of energy, economic sanctions, and of course this East-West divide. I'll leave you with a quote from Peter Hartsook, who was commissioned to do a piece on by the Carnegie Foundation, I believe, and he just says health diplomacy is the great leveler which brings countries together in a common cause, fighting one of humanity's most ancient and powerful foes, diseases. And he's actually the person who set me on this journey to explore this topic. So thank you very much. We'll let questions till the end, and we'll introduce Sebastian.